The strategy of producing equal numbers of sons and daughters is an evolutionarily stable strategy, in the sense that any gene for departing from it makes a net loss. I've told the story in terms of numbers of sons versus numbers of daughters. This is to make it simple, but strictly it should be worked out in terms of parental investment, meaning all the food and other resources that a parent has to offer, measured in the way discussed in the previous chapter. Parents should invest equally in sons and daughters. This usually means they should have numerically as many sons as they have daughters. But there could be unequal sex ratios that were evolutionarily stable, provided correspondingly unequal amounts of resources were invested in sons and daughters. In the case of the elephant seals, a policy of having three times as many daughters as sons, but of making each son a super male by investing three times as much food and other resources in him, could be stable. By investing more food in a son and making him big and strong, a parent might increase his chances of winning the supreme prize of a harem. But this is a special case. Normally, the amount invested in each son will roughly equal the amount invested in each daughter, and the sex ratio, in terms of numbers, is usually 1-1.
In its long journey down the generations, therefore, an average gene will spend approximately half its time sitting in male bodies and the other half sitting in female bodies. Some gene effects show themselves only in bodies of one sex. These are called sex-limited gene effects. A gene controlling penis length expresses this effect only in male bodies, but it's carried about in female bodies too, and may have some quite different effect on female bodies. There is no reason why a man should not inherit a tendency to develop a long penis from his mother. In whichever of the two sorts of body it finds itself, we can expect a gene to make the best use of the opportunities offered by that sort of body. These opportunities may well differ according to whether the body is male or female. As a convenient approximation, we can once again assume that each individual body is a selfish machine trying to do the best for all its genes. The best policy for such a selfish machine will often be one thing if it is male and quite a different thing if it is female. For brevity, we shall again use the convention of thinking of the individual as though it had a conscious purpose. As before, we shall hold in the back of our mind that this is just a figure of speech. A body is really a machine blindly programmed by its selfish genes. Consider again the mated pair with which we began the chapter. Both partners, as selfish machines, want sons and daughters in equal numbers. To this extent, they agree. Where they disagree is in who is going to bear the brunt of the cost of rearing each one of those children. Each individual wants as many surviving children as possible. The less he or she is obliged to invest in any one of those children, the more children he or she can have. The obvious way to achieve this desirable state of affairs is to induce your sexual partner to invest more than his or her fair share of resources in each child, leaving you free to have other children with other partners. This would be a desirable strategy for either sex, but it is more difficult for the female to achieve. Since she starts by investing more than the male in the form of her large, food-rich egg, a mother is already, at the moment of conception, committed to each child more deeply than the father is. She stands to lose more if the child dies than the father does. More to the point, she would have to invest more than the father in the future in order to bring a new substitute child up to the same level of development. If she tried the tactic of leaving the father holding the baby while she went off with another male, the father might, at relatively small cost to himself, retaliate by abandoning the baby too. Therefore, at least in the early stages of child development, if any abandoning is going to be done, it is likely to be the father who abandons the mother rather than the other way round. Similarly, females can be expected to invest more in children than males, not only at the outset, but throughout development. So, in mammals, for example, it is the female who incubates the fetus in her own body, the female who makes the milk to suckle it when it is born, the female who bears the brunt of the load of bringing it up and protecting it. The female sex is exploited, and the fundamental evolutionary basis for the exploitation is the fact that eggs are larger than sperms.
Of course, in many species, the father does work hard and faithfully at looking after the young. But even so, we must expect that there will normally be some evolutionary pressure on males to invest a little bit less in each child and to try to have more children by different wives. By this, I simply mean that there will be a tendency for genes that say, body, if you are male, leave your mate a little bit earlier than my rival allele would have you do and look for another female, to be successful in the gene pool. The extent to which this evolutionary pressure actually prevails in practice varies greatly from species to species. In many, for example in the birds of paradise, the female receives no help at all from any male, and she rears her children on her own. Other species, such as kittiwakes, form monogamous pair bonds of exemplary fidelity, and both partners cooperate in the work of bringing up children. Here we must suppose that some evolutionary counter-pressure has been at work. There must be a penalty attached to the selfish mate exploitation strategy, as well as a benefit, and in kittiwakes, the penalty outweighs the benefit. It will, in any case, only pay a father to desert his wife and child if the wife has a reasonable chance of rearing the child on her own. Trivers has considered the possible courses of action open to a mother who has been deserted by her mate. Best of all for her would be to try to deceive another male into adopting her child, thinking it is his own. This might not be too difficult if it is still a fetus not yet born. Of course, while the child bears half her genes, it bears no genes at all from the gullible stepfather. Natural selection would severely penalize such gullibility in males, and indeed would favor males who took active steps to kill any potential stepchildren as soon as they mated with a new wife. This is very probably the explanation of the so-called Bruce effect. Male mice secrete a chemical which, when smelt by a pregnant female, can cause her to abort. She only aborts if the smell is different from that of her former mate. In this way, a male mouse destroys his potential stepchildren and renders his new wife receptive to his own sexual advances. Ardrey, incidentally, sees the Bruce effect as a population control mechanism. A similar example is that of male lions, who, when newly arrived in a pride, sometimes murder existing cubs, presumably because these are not their own children. A male can achieve the same result without necessarily killing stepchildren. He can enforce a period of prolonged courtship before he copulates with a female, driving away all other males who approach her and preventing her from escaping. In this way, he can wait and see whether she is harboring any little stepchildren in her womb and desert her if so. We shall see below a reason why a female might want a long engagement period before copulation. Here we have a reason why a male might want one too. Provided he can isolate her from all contact with other males, it helps to avoid being the unwitting benefactor of another male's children.
Assuming then that a deserted female cannot fool a new male into adopting her child, what else can she do? Much may depend on how old the child is. If it is only just conceived, it is true that she has invested the whole of one egg in it, and perhaps more, but it may still pay her to abort it and find a new mate as quickly as possible. In these circumstances, it would be to the mutual advantage both of her and of the potential new husband that she should abort, since we are assuming she has no hope of fooling him into adopting the child. This could explain why the Bruce effect works from the female's point of view. Another option open to a deserted female is to stick it out and try and rear the child on her own. This will especially pay her if the child is already quite old. The older he is, the more has already been invested in him and the less it will take out of her to finish the job of rearing him. Even if he's still quite young, it might yet pay her to try to salvage something from her initial investment, even if she has to work twice as hard to feed the child now that the male has gone. It is no comfort to her that the child contains half the male's genes too, and that she could spite him by abandoning it. There's no point in spite for its own sake. The child carries half her genes, and the dilemma is now hers alone. Paradoxically, a reasonable policy for a female who is in danger of being deserted might be to walk out on the male before he walks out on her. This could pay her, even if she has already invested more in the child than the male has. The unpleasant truth is that in some circumstances, an advantage accrues to the partner who deserts first, whether it is the father or the mother. As Trivers puts it, the partner who is left behind is placed in a cruel bind. It is a rather horrible but very subtle argument. A parent may be expected to desert the moment it is possible for him or her to say the following. This child is now far enough developed that either of us could finish off rearing it on our own. Therefore, it would pay me to desert now, provided I could be sure my partner would not desert as well. If I did desert now, my partner would do whatever is best for his/her genes. He/she would be forced into making a more drastic decision than I am making now, because I would have already left. My partner would know that if he/she left as well, the child would surely die. Therefore, assuming that my partner will take the decision that is best for his/her own selfish genes, I conclude that my own best course of action is to desert first. This is especially so since my partner may be thinking along exactly the same lines and may seize the initiative at any minute by deserting me. As always, the subjective soliloquy is intended for illustration only. The point is that genes for deserting first could be favourably selected simply because genes for deserting second would not be.
We have looked at some of the things that a female might do if she has been deserted by her mate. But these all have the air of making the best of a bad job. Is there anything a female can do to reduce the extent to which her mate exploits her in the first place? She has a strong card in her hand. She can refuse to copulate. She is in demand in a seller's market. This is because she brings the dowry of a large, nutritious egg. A male who successfully copulates gains a valuable food reserve for his offspring. The female is potentially in a position to drive a hard bargain before she copulates. Once she has copulated, she has played her ace. Her egg has been committed to the male. It is all very well to talk about driving hard bargains, but we know very well it is not really like that. Is there any realistic way in which something equivalent to driving a hard bargain could evolve by natural selection? We shall consider two main possibilities, called the domestic bliss strategy and the he-man strategy. The simplest version of the domestic bliss strategy is this. The female looks the males over and tries to spot signs of fidelity and domesticity in advance. There is bound to be variation in the population of males in their predisposition to be faithful husbands. If females could recognize such qualities in advance, they could benefit themselves by choosing males possessing them. One way for a female to do this is to play hard to get for a long time, to be coy. Any male who is not patient enough to wait until the female eventually consents to copulate is not likely to be a good bet as a faithful husband. By insisting on a long engagement period, a female weeds out casual suitors and only finally copulates with a male who has proved his qualities of fidelity and perseverance in advance. Feminine coyness is in fact very common among animals, and so are prolonged courtship or engagement periods. As we've already seen, a long engagement can also benefit a male where there is a danger of his being duped into caring for another male's child.
Courtship rituals often include considerable pre-copulation investment by the male. The female may refuse to copulate until the male has built her a nest, or the male may have to feed her quite substantial amounts of food. This, of course, is very good from the female's point of view, but it also suggests another possible version of the domestic bliss strategy. Could females force males to invest so heavily in their offspring before they allow copulation that it would no longer pay the males to desert after copulation? The idea is appealing. A male who waits for a coy female eventually to copulate with him is paying a cost. He is foregoing the chance to copulate with other females, and he is spending a lot of time and energy in courting her. By the time he is finally allowed to copulate with a particular female, he will inevitably be heavily committed to her. There will be little temptation for him to desert her if he knows that any future female he approaches will also procrastinate in the same manner before she will get down to business.
As I showed in a paper, there is a mistake in Trivers's reasoning here. He thought that prior investment in itself committed an individual to future investment. This is fallacious economics. A businessman should never say, "I have already invested so much in the Concorde airliner, for instance, that I cannot afford to scrap it now." He should always ask instead whether it would pay him in the future to cut his losses and abandon the project now, even though he has already invested heavily in it. Similarly, it is no use a female forcing a male to invest heavily in her in the hope that this on its own will deter the male from subsequently deserting. This version of the domestic bliss strategy depends upon one further crucial assumption. This is that a majority of the females can be relied upon to play the same game. If there are loose females in the population, prepared to welcome males who have deserted their wives, then it could pay a male to desert his wife, no matter how much he has already invested in her children. Much, therefore, depends on how the majority of females behave. If we were allowed to think in terms of a conspiracy of females, there would be no problem. But a conspiracy of females can no more evolve than the conspiracy of doves, which we considered in Chapter 5. Instead, we must look for evolutionarily stable strategies. Let us take Maynard Smith's method of analysing aggressive contests and apply it to sex. It will be a little bit more complicated than the case of the hawks and doves, because we shall have two female strategies and two male strategies.
As in Maynard Smith's studies, the word strategy refers to a blind, unconscious behaviour programme. Our two female strategies will be called coy and fast, and the two male strategies will be called faithful and philanderer. The behavioural rules of the four types are as follows. Coy females will not copulate with a male until he's gone through a long and expensive courtship period lasting several weeks. Fast females will copulate immediately with anybody. Faithful males are prepared to go on courting for a long time, and after copulation they stay with the female and help her to rear the young. Philanderer males lose patience quickly if a female will not copulate with them straight away. They go off and look for another female. After copulation, too, they do not stay and act as good fathers, but go off in search of fresh females. As in the case of the hawks and doves, these are not the only possible strategies, but it is illuminating to study their fates nevertheless. Like Maynard Smith, we shall use some arbitrary hypothetical values for the various costs and benefits. To be more general, it can be done with algebraic symbols, but numbers are easier to understand. Suppose that the genetic payoff gained by each parent when a child is reared successfully is plus 15 units. The cost of rearing one child, the cost of all its food, all the time spent looking after it, and all the risks taken on its behalf, is minus 20 units. The cost is expressed as negative because it is paid out by the parents. Also negative is the cost of wasting time in prolonged courtship. Let this cost be minus 3 units.
Imagine we have a population in which all the females are coy and all the males are faithful. It is an ideal monogamous society. In each couple, the male and the female both get the same average payoff. They get plus 15 for each child reared. They share the cost of rearing it, minus 20, equally between the two of them, an average of minus 10 each. They both pay the minus 3-point penalty for wasting time in prolonged courtship. The average payoff for each is therefore plus 15, minus 10, minus 3, equals plus 2. Now suppose a single fast female enters the population. She does very well. She does not pay the cost of delay because she does not indulge in prolonged courtship. Since all the males in the population are faithful, she can reckon on finding a good father for her children, whoever she mates with. Her average payoff per child is plus 15 minus 10, which equals plus 5. She is 3 units better off than her coy rivals. Therefore, fast genes will start to spread. If the success of fast females is so great that they come to predominate in the population, things will start to change in the male camp too. So far, faithful males have had a monopoly. But now, if a philanderer male arises in the population, he starts to do better than his faithful rivals. In a population where all the females are fast, the pickings for a philanderer male are rich indeed. He gets the plus 15 points if a child is successfully reared, and he pays neither of the two costs. What this lack of cost mainly means to him is that he is free to go off and mate with new females. Each of his unfortunate wives struggles on alone with the child, paying the entire minus 20 point cost, although she does not pay anything for wasting time in courting. The net payoff for a fast female when she encounters a philanderer male is plus 15 minus 20, which equals minus 5. The payoff to the philanderer himself is plus 15. In a population in which all the females are fast, philanderer genes will spread like wildfire.
If the philanderers increase so successfully that they come to dominate the male part of the population, the fast females will be in dire straits. Any coy female would have a strong advantage. If a coy female encounters a philanderer male, no business results. She insists on prolonged courtship, he refuses and goes off in search of another female. Neither partner pays the cost of wasting time. Neither gains anything either, since no child is produced. This gives a net payoff of zero for a coy female in a population where all the males are philanderers. Zero may not seem much, but it is better than minus 5, which is the average score for a fast female. Even if a fast female decided to leave her young after being deserted by a philanderer, she would still have paid the considerable cost of an egg. So coy genes start to spread through the population again. To complete the hypothetical cycle, when coy females increase in numbers so much that they predominate, the philanderer males, who had such an easy time with the fast females, start to feel the pinch. Female after female insists on a long and arduous courtship. The philanderers flit from female to female, and always the story is the same. The net payoff for a philanderer male when all the females are coy is zero. Now if a single faithful male should turn up, he is the only one with whom the coy females will mate. His net payoff is plus 2, better than that of the philanderers. So faithful genes start to increase, and we come full circle.
End note. This idea of trying to find an evolutionarily stable mix of strategies within one sex, balanced by an evolutionarily stable mix of strategies in the other sex, has now been taken further by Maynard Smith himself, and independently but in a similar direction, by Alan Graffen and Richard Sibley. Graffen and Sibley's paper is the more technically advanced, Maynard Smith's the easier to explain in words. Briefly, he begins by considering two strategies, guard and desert, which can be adopted by either sex. As in my coy, fast and faithful philanderer model, the interesting question is what combinations of strategies among males are stable against what combinations of strategies among females? The answer depends upon our assumption about the particular economic circumstances of the species. Interestingly, though, however much we vary the economic assumptions, we don't have a whole continuum of quantitatively varying stable outcomes. The model tends to home in on one of only four stable outcomes. The four outcomes are named after animal species that exemplify them. There is the duck, male deserts, female guards, the stickleback, female deserts, male guards, the fruit fly, both desert, and the gibbon, both guard. And here is something even more interesting. Remember from Chapter 5 that ESS models can settle at either of two outcomes, both equally stable. Well, that is true of this Maynard Smith model too. What is especially interesting is that particular pairs, as opposed to other pairs of these outcomes, are jointly stable under the same economic circumstances. For instance, under one range of circumstances, both duck and stickleback are stable. Which of the two actually arises depends upon luck, or more precisely, upon accidents of evolutionary history, initial conditions. Under another range of circumstances, both gibbon and fruit fly are stable. Again, it is historical accident that determines which of the two occurs in any given species. But there are no circumstances in which gibbon and duck are jointly stable, no circumstances in which duck and fruit fly are jointly stable. This stablemate, to coin a double pun, analysis of congenial and uncongenial combinations of ESSs has interesting consequences for our reconstructions of evolutionary history. For instance, it leads us to expect that certain kinds of transitions between mating systems in evolutionary history will be probable, others improbable. Maynard Smith explores these historical networks in a brief survey of mating patterns throughout the animal kingdom, ending with the memorable rhetorical question, why don't male mammals lactate?
As in the case of the aggression analysis, we have told the story as though it was an endless oscillation. But as in that case, it can be shown that really there would be no oscillation. The system would converge to a stable state. If you do the sums, it turns out that a population in which 5/6 of the females are coy and 5/8 of the males are faithful is evolutionarily stable. This is, of course, just for the particular arbitrary numbers that we started out with, but it's easy to work out what the stable ratios would be for any other arbitrary assumptions. As in Maynard Smith's analyses, we do not have to think of there being two different sorts of male and two different sorts of female. The ESS could equally well be achieved if each male spends 5/8 of his time being faithful and the rest of his time philandering, and each female spends 5/6 of her time being coy and 1/6 of her time being fast.
End note. I am sorry to say that my statement that the system would converge to a stable state is wrong. It is wrong in an interesting way, however, so I've left the error in and shall now take some time to expose it. It is actually the same kind of error as Gale and Eve spotted in Maynard Smith and Price's original paper, as I noted earlier. My error was pointed out by two mathematical biologists working in Austria, P. Schuster and K. Sigmund. I had correctly worked out the ratios of faithful to philanderer males and of coy to fast females, at which the two kinds of males were equally successful, and the two kinds of females were equally successful. This is indeed an equilibrium, but I failed to check whether it was a stable equilibrium. It could have been a precarious knife edge rather than a secure valley. In order to check for stability, we have to see what would happen if we perturb the equilibrium slightly. Push a ball off a knife edge and you lose it. Push it away from the center of a valley and it comes back. In my particular numerical example, the equilibrium ratio for males was 5/8 faithful and 3/8 philanderer. Now, what if by chance the proportion of philanderers in the population increases to a value slightly higher than equilibrium? In order for the equilibrium to qualify as stable and self-correcting, it is necessary that philanderers should immediately start doing slightly less well. Unfortunately, as Schuster and Sigmund showed, this is not what happens. On the contrary, philanderers start doing better. Their frequency in the population, then, far from being self-stabilizing, is self-enhancing. It increases, not forever, but only up to a point. If you simulate the model dynamically on a computer, as I have now done, you get an endlessly repeating cycle. Ironically, this is precisely the cycle that I described hypothetically in my example of coy, fast females and philanderer, faithful males, but I thought that I was doing it purely as an explanatory device, just as I had with hawks and doves. By analogy with hawks and doves, I assumed, quite wrongly, that the cycle was hypothetical only, and that the system would really settle into a stable equilibrium. Schuster and Sigmund's parting shot leaves no more to be said. Briefly, then, we can draw two conclusions. A, that the battle of sexes has much in common with predation, and B, that the behavior of lovers is oscillating like the moon and unpredictable as the weather. Of course, people didn't need differential equations to notice this before.
Whichever way we think of the ESS, what it means is this. Any tendency for members of either sex to deviate from their appropriate stable ratio will be penalized by a consequent change in the ratio of strategies of the other sex, which is, in turn, to the disadvantage of the original deviant. Therefore, the ESS will be preserved. We can conclude that it is certainly possible for a population consisting largely of coy females and faithful males to evolve. In these circumstances, the domestic bliss strategy for females really does seem to work. We do not have to think in terms of a conspiracy of coy females. Coyness can actually pay a female's selfish genes.
There are various ways in which females can put this type of strategy into practice. I have already suggested that a female might refuse to copulate with a male who has not already built her a nest, or at least helped her to build a nest. It is indeed the case that in many monogamous birds, copulation does not take place until after the nest is built. The effect of this is that at the moment of conception, the male has invested a good deal more in the child than just his cheap sperms. Demanding that a prospective mate should build a nest is one effective way for a female to trap him. It might be thought that almost anything that costs the male a great deal would do in theory, even if that cost is not directly paid in the form of benefit to the unborn children. If all females of a population forced males to do some difficult and costly deed, like slaying a dragon or climbing a mountain, before they would consent to copulate with them, they could in theory be reducing the temptation for the males to desert after copulation. Any male tempted to desert his mate and try to spread more of his genes by another female would be put off by the thought that he would have to kill another dragon. In practice, however, it is unlikely that females would impose such arbitrary tasks as dragon-killing or holy grail-seeking on their suitors. The reason is that a rival female who imposed a task no less arduous but more useful to her and her children would have an advantage over more romantically-minded females who demanded a pointless labor of love. Building a nest may be less romantic than slaying a dragon or swimming the Hellespont, but it is much more useful. Also useful to the female is the practice I've already mentioned of courtship feeding by the male. In birds, this has usually been regarded as a kind of regression to juvenile behavior on the part of the female. She begs from the male, using the same gestures as a young bird would use. It has been supposed that this is automatically attractive to the male, in the same way as a man finds a lisp or pouting lips attractive in an adult woman. The female bird at this time needs all the extra food she can get, for she's building up her reserves for the effort of manufacturing her enormous eggs. Courtship feeding by the male probably represents direct investment by him in the eggs themselves. It therefore has the effect of reducing the disparity between the two parents in their initial investment in the young.
Several insects and spiders also demonstrate the phenomenon of courtship feeding. Here, an alternative interpretation has sometimes been only too obvious. Since, as in the case of the praying mantis, the male may be in danger of being eaten by the larger female, anything that he can do to reduce her appetite may be to his advantage. There is a macabre sense in which the unfortunate male mantis can be said to invest in his children. He is used as food to help make the eggs, which will then be fertilized posthumously by his own stored sperms. A female playing the domestic bliss strategy, who simply looks the males over and tries to recognize qualities of fidelity in advance, lays herself open to deception. Any male who can pass himself off as a good, loyal domestic type, but who in reality is concealing a strong tendency towards desertion and unfaithfulness, could have a great advantage. As long as his deserted former wives have any chance of bringing up some of the children, the philanderer stands to pass on more genes than a rival male who is an honest husband and father. Genes for effective deception by males will tend to be favored in the gene pool. Conversely, natural selection will tend to favor females who become good at seeing through such deception. One way they can do this is to play especially hard to get when they are courted by a new male, but in successive breeding seasons to be increasingly ready to accept quickly the advances of last year's mate. This will automatically penalise young males embarking on their first breeding season, whether they are deceivers or not. The brood of naive first-year females would tend to contain a relatively high proportion of genes from unfaithful fathers, but faithful fathers have the advantage in the second and subsequent years of a mother's life, for they do not have to go through the same prolonged, energy-wasting and time-consuming courtship rituals. If the majority of individuals in a population are the children of experienced rather than naive mothers, a reasonable assumption in any long-lived species, genes for honest, good fatherhood will come to prevail in the gene pool.
For simplicity, I've talked as though a male were either purely honest or thoroughly deceitful. In reality, it is more probable that all males, indeed all individuals, are a little bit deceitful in that they are programmed to take advantage of opportunities to exploit their mates. Natural selection, by sharpening up the ability of each partner to detect dishonesty in the other, has kept large-scale deceit down to a fairly low level. Males have more to gain from dishonesty than females, and we must expect that, even in those species where males show considerable parental altruism, they will usually tend to do a bit less work than the females and to be a bit more ready to abscond. In birds and mammals, this is certainly normally the case. There are species, however, in which the male actually does more work in caring for the children than the female does. Among birds and mammals, these cases of paternal devotion are exceptionally rare, but they are common among fish. Why? This is a challenge for the selfish gene theory, which has puzzled me for a long time. An ingenious solution was recently suggested to me in a tutorial by Miss T.R. Carlyle. She makes use of Trivers's cruel bind idea referred to above as follows.
Many fish do not copulate, but instead simply spew out their sex cells into the water. Fertilization takes place in the open water, not inside the body of one of the partners. This is probably how sexual reproduction first began. Land animals, like birds, mammals, and reptiles, on the other hand, cannot afford this kind of external fertilization because their sex cells are too vulnerable to drying up. The gametes of one sex, the male, since sperms are mobile, are introduced into the wet interior of a member of the other sex, the female. So much is just fact. Now comes the idea. After copulation, the land-dwelling female is left in physical possession of the embryo. It is inside her body. Even if she lays the fertilized egg almost immediately, the male still has time to vanish, thereby forcing the female into Trivers's cruel bind. The male is inevitably provided with an opportunity to take the prior decision to desert, closing the female's options and forcing her to decide whether to leave the young to certain death or whether to stay with it and rear it. Therefore, maternal care is more common among land animals than paternal care. But for fish and other water-dwelling animals, things are very different. If the male does not physically introduce his sperms into the female's body, there is no necessary sense in which the female is left holding the baby. Either partner might make a quick getaway and leave the other one in possession of the newly fertilized eggs. But there is even a possible reason why it might often be the male who is most vulnerable to being deserted. It seems probable that an evolutionary battle will develop over who sheds their sex cells first. The partner who does so has the advantage that he or she can then leave the other one in possession of the new embryos. On the other hand, the partner who spawns first runs the risk that his prospective partner may subsequently fail to follow suit. Now the male is more vulnerable here, if only because sperms are lighter and more likely to diffuse than eggs. If a female spawns too early, in other words, before the male is ready, it will not greatly matter because the eggs, being relatively large and heavy, are likely to stay together as a coherent clutch for some time. Therefore, a female fish can afford to take the risk of spawning early. The male dare not take this risk, since if he spawns too early, his sperms will have diffused away before the female is ready, and she will then not spawn herself, because it will not be worth her while to do so. Because of the diffusion problem, the male must wait until the female spawns, and then he must shed his sperms over the eggs. But she has had a precious few seconds in which to disappear, leaving the male in possession and forcing him onto the horns of Trivers's dilemma. So this theory neatly explains why paternal care is common in water but rare on dry land.
End note. Tamsin Carlyle's undergraduate hypothesis about fish has now been tested comparatively by Mark Ridley in the course of an exhaustive review of paternal care in the entire animal kingdom. His paper is an astonishing tour de force, which, like Carlyle's hypothesis itself, also began as an undergraduate essay written for me. Unfortunately, he did not find in favour of the hypothesis.
Leaving fish, we now turn to the other main female strategy, the he-man strategy. In species where this policy is adopted, the females in effect resign themselves to getting no help from the father of their children and go all out for good genes instead. Once again, they use their weapon of withholding copulation. They refuse to mate with just any male, but exercise the utmost care and discrimination before they will allow a male to copulate with them. Some males undoubtedly do contain a larger number of good genes than other males, genes that would benefit the survival prospects of both sons and daughters. If a female can somehow detect good genes in males using externally visible clues, she can benefit her own genes by allying them with good paternal genes. To use our analogy of the rowing crews, a female can minimize the chance that her genes will be dragged down through getting into bad company. She can try to hand-pick good crewmates for her own genes. The chances are that most of the females will agree with each other on which are the best males, since they all have the same information to go on. Therefore, these few lucky males will do most of the copulating. This they are quite capable of doing, since all they must give to each female is some cheap sperms. This is presumably what has happened in elephant seals and in birds of paradise. The females are allowing just a few males to get away with the ideal selfish exploitation strategy which all males aspire to, but they are making sure that only the best males are allowed this luxury.
From the point of view of a female trying to pick good genes with which to ally her own, what is she looking for? One thing she wants is evidence of ability to survive. Obviously, any potential mate who is courting her has proved his ability to survive at least into adulthood, but he has not necessarily proved that he can survive much longer. Quite a good policy for a female might be to go for old males. Whatever their shortcomings, they have at least proved they can survive, and she is likely to be allying her genes with genes for longevity. However, there is no point in ensuring that her children live long lives if they do not also give her lots of grandchildren. Longevity is not prima facie evidence of virility. Indeed, a long-lived male may have survived precisely because he does not take risks in order to reproduce. A female who selects an old male is not necessarily going to have more descendants than a rival female who chooses a young one who shows some other evidence of good genes. What other evidence? There are many possibilities, perhaps strong muscles as evidence of ability to catch food, perhaps long legs as evidence of ability to run away from predators. A female might benefit her genes by allying them with such traits, since they might be useful qualities in both her sons and her daughters. To begin with, then, we have to imagine females choosing males on the basis of perfectly genuine labels or indicators, which tend to be evidence of good underlying genes. But now here is a very interesting point realized by Darwin and clearly enunciated by Fisher. In a society where males compete with each other to be chosen as he-men by females, one of the best things a mother can do for her genes is to make a son who will turn out in his turn to be an attractive he-man. If she can ensure that her son is one of the fortunate few males who wins most of the copulations in the society when he grows up, she will have an enormous number of grandchildren. The result of this is that one of the most desirable qualities a male can have in the eyes of a female is, quite simply, sexual attractiveness itself. A female who mates with a super-attractive he-man is more likely to have sons who are attractive to females of the next generation, and who will make lots of grandchildren for her. Originally, then, females may be thought of as selecting males on the basis of obviously useful qualities, like big muscles. But once such qualities became widely accepted as attractive among the females of the species, natural selection would continue to favor them simply because they were attractive.
Extravagances, such as the tales of male birds of paradise, may therefore have evolved by a kind of unstable runaway process. In the early days, a slightly longer tail than usual may have been selected by females as a desirable quality in males, perhaps because it betokened a fit and healthy constitution. A short tail on a male might have been an indicator of some vitamin deficiency, evidence of poor food-getting ability. Or perhaps short-tailed males were not very good at running away from predators, and so had had their tails bitten off. Notice that we don't have to assume that the short tail was in itself genetically inherited, only that it served as an indicator of some genetic inferiority. Anyway, for whatever reason, let us suppose that females in the ancestral bird-of-paradise species preferentially went for males with longer-than-average tails. Provided there was some genetic contribution to the natural variation in male tail length, this would, in time, cause the average tail length of males in the population to increase. Females followed a simple rule. Look all the males over and go for the one with the longest tail. Any female who departed from this rule was penalized, even if tails had already become so long that they actually encumbered males possessing them. This was because any female who did not produce long-tailed sons had little chance of one of her sons being regarded as attractive. Like a fashion in women's clothes, or in American car design, the trend toward longer tails took off and gathered its own momentum. It was stopped only when tails became so grotesquely long that their manifest disadvantages started to outweigh the advantage of sexual attractiveness. This is a hard idea to swallow, and it has attracted its skeptics ever since Darwin first proposed it under the name of sexual selection.
Endnote. R.A. Fisher's runaway theory of sexual selection, which he stated extremely briefly, has now been spelled out mathematically by R. Landy and others. It has become a difficult subject, but it can be explained in non-mathematical terms, provided sufficient space is given over to it. It does need a whole chapter, however, and I devoted one to it in The Blind Watchmaker, Chapter 8, so I'll say no more about it here. Instead, I'll deal with one problem about sexual selection that I've never sufficiently emphasized in any of my books. How is the necessary variation maintained? Darwinian selection can function only if there is a good supply of genetic variation to work upon. If you try to breed, say, rabbits for ever longer ears, to begin with you'll succeed. The average rabbit in a wild population will have medium-sized ears, by rabbit standards. By our standards, of course, it will have very long ones. A few rabbits will have shorter than average ears and a few longer than average. By breeding only from those with the longest ears, you'll succeed in increasing the average in later generations. For a while. But if you continue to breed from those with the longest ears, there will come a time when the necessary variation is no longer available. They'll all have the longest ears, and evolution will grind to a halt. In normal evolution, this sort of thing is not a problem, because most environments don't carry on exerting consistent and unswerving pressure in one direction. The best length for any particular part of an animal will normally not be a bit longer than the present average, whatever the present average may be. The best length is more likely to be a fixed quantity, say 3 inches. But sexual selection really can have the embarrassing property of chasing an ever-driving optimum. Female fashion really could desire ever longer male ears, no matter how long the ears of the current population might already be. So variation really could seriously run out. And yet, sexual selection does seem to have worked. We do see absurdly exaggerated male ornaments. We seem to have a paradox, which we may call the paradox of the vanishing variation. Landy's solution to the paradox is mutation. There will always be enough mutation, he thinks, to fuel sustained selection. The reason people had doubted this before was that they thought in terms of one gene at a time. Mutation rates at any one genetic locus are too low to resolve the paradox of vanishing variation. Landy reminded us that tails and other things that sexual selection works on are influenced by an indefinitely large number of different genes, polygenes, whose small effects all add up. Moreover, as evolution goes on, it will be a shifting set of polygenes that are relevant. New genes will be recruited into the set that influence variation in tail length, and old ones lost. Mutation can affect any of this large and shifting set of genes, so the paradox of vanishing variation itself vanishes. W.D. Hamilton's answer to the paradox is different. He answered it in the same way he answers most questions nowadays, parasites. Think back to the rabbit ears. The best length for rabbit ears presumably depends on various acoustic factors. There is no particular reason to expect these factors to change in a consistent and sustained direction as generations go by. The best length for rabbit ears may not be absolutely constant, but still selection is unlikely to push so far in any particular direction that it strays outside the range of variation easily thrown up by the present gene pool. Hence, no paradox of vanishing variation. But now look at the kind of violently fluctuating environment provided by parasites. In a world full of parasites, there is strong selection in favor of ability to resist them. Natural selection will favor whichever individual rabbits are least vulnerable to the parasites that happen to be around. The crucial point is that these will not always be the same parasites. Plagues come and go. Today it may be myxomatosis, next year the rabbit equivalent of the Black Death, the year after that rabbit AIDS and so on. Then after, say, a 10-year cycle, it may be back to myxomatosis and so on. Or the myxomatosis virus may itself evolve to counter whatever counter-adaptations the rabbits come up with. Hamilton pictures cycles of counter-adaptations and counter-counter-adaptations endlessly rolling through time and forever perversely updating the definition of the best rabbit. The upshot of all this is that there is something importantly different about adaptations for disease resistance as compared with adaptations to the physical environment. Whereas there may be a pretty fixed best length for a rabbit's legs to be, there is no fixed best rabbit as far as disease resistance is concerned. As the currently most dangerous disease changes, so the currently best rabbit changes. Are parasites the only selective forces that work this way? What about predators and prey, for instance? Hamilton agrees that they are basically like parasites, but they don't evolve so fast as many parasites. And parasites are more likely than predators or prey to evolve detailed gene-for-gene counter-adaptations. Hamilton takes the cyclical changes offered by parasites and makes them the basis for an altogether grander theory, his theory of why sex exists at all. But here we are concerned with his use of parasites to solve the paradox of vanishing variation in sexual selection. He believes that hereditary disease resistance among males is the most important criterion by which females choose them. Disease is such a powerful scourge that females will benefit greatly from any ability they may have to diagnose it in potential mates. A female who behaves like a good diagnostic doctor and chooses only the healthiest male for mate will tend to gain healthy genes for her children. Now, because the definition of the best rabbit is always changing, there will always be something important for females to choose between when they look the males over. There will always be some good males and some bad males. They won't all become good after generations of selection, because by then the parasites will have changed, and so the definition of a good rabbit will have changed. genes for resisting one strain of myxomavirus will not be good at resisting the next strain of myxomavirus that mutates onto the scene. And so on through indefinite cycles of evolving pestilence. Parasites never let up, so females cannot let up in their relentless search for healthy mates. How will the males respond to being scrutinized by females acting as doctors? Will genes for faking good health be favored? To begin with, maybe, but selection will then act on females to sharpen up their diagnostic skills and sort out the fakes from the really healthy. In the end, Hamilton believes, females will become such good doctors that males will be forced, if they advertise at all, to advertise honestly. If any sexual advertisement becomes exaggerated in males, it will be because it is a genuine indicator of health. Males will evolve so as to make it easy for females to see that they are healthy, if they are. Genuinely healthy males will be pleased to advertise the fact. Unhealthy ones, of course, will not, but what can they do? If they don't at least try to display a health certificate, females will draw the worst conclusions. By the way, all this talk of doctors would be misleading if it suggested that females are interested in curing males. Their only interest is diagnosis, and it is not an altruistic interest. And I'm assuming that it is no longer necessary to apologize for metaphors like honesty and drawing conclusions. To return to the point about advertising, it is as though males are forced by the females to evolve clinical thermometers permanently sticking out of their mouths, clearly displayed for females to read. What might these thermometers be? Well, think of the spectacularly long tail of a male bird of paradise. We have already seen Fisher's elegant explanation for this elegant adornment. Hamilton's explanation is altogether more down to earth. A common symptom of disease in a bird is diarrhea. If you have a long tail, diarrhea is likely to mess it up. If you want to conceal the fact that you are suffering from diarrhea, the best way to avoid it would be to avoid having a long tail. By the same token, if you want to advertise the fact that you are not suffering from diarrhea, the best way to do so would be to have a very long tail. That way, the fact that your tail is clean will be the more conspicuous. If you don't have much of a tail at all, females cannot see whether it is clean or not, and will conclude the worst. Hamilton would not wish to commit himself to this particular explanation for bird-of-paradise tails, but it is a good example of the kind of explanation that he favours. I use the simile of females acting as diagnostic doctors and males making their task easy by sporting thermometers all over the place. Thinking about other diagnostic standbys of the doctor, the blood pressure meter and the stethoscope, led me to a couple of speculations about human sexual selection. I'll briefly present them, though I admit that I find them less plausible than pleasing. First, a theory about why humans have lost the penis bone. An erect human penis can be so hard and stiff that people jokingly express skepticism that there is no bone inside. As a matter of fact, lots of mammals do have a stiffening bone, the baculum or os penis, to help the erection along. What's more, it is common among our relatives, the primates. Even our closest cousin, the chimpanzee, has one, although admittedly a very tiny one, which may be on its evolutionary way out. There seems to have been a tendency to reduce the os penis in the primates. Our species, along with a couple of monkey species, has lost it completely. So, we have got rid of the bone that in our ancestors presumably made it easy to have a nice stiff penis. Instead, we rely on a hydraulic pumping system, which one cannot but feel is a costly and roundabout way of doing things. And notoriously, erection can fail, unfortunate to say the least, for the genetic success of a male in the wild. What is the obvious remedy? A bone in the penis, of course. So why don't we evolve one? For once, biologists of the Genetic Constraints Brigade cannot cop out with, oh, the necessary variation just couldn't arise. Until recently, our ancestors had precisely such a bone, and we've actually gone out of our way to lose it. Why? Erection in humans is accomplished purely by pressure of blood. It is unfortunately not plausible to suggest that erection hardness is the equivalent of a doctor's blood pressure meter used by females to gauge male health. But we are not tied to the metaphor of the blood pressure meter. If, for whatever reason, erection failure is a sensitive early warning of certain kinds of ill health,